Greg, and it's indeed a great privilege to be able to talk and honour Professor Malcolm Sumner. As Martin Fay indicated earlier, he and I had the great privilege of actually being undergraduates with Malcolm, so he was our mentor. I wouldn't be standing here today if it weren't be for the inspiration that in fact he's given us over the years. So well, we're talking now close to 4.5 decades of association with Malcolm, and that is quite incredible. Not only that, but Malcolm actually got me started and employed me almost a little over 4 decades ago to do work on sodic and saline soils on the Jasini Dam. And that, I guess, was the start of my career. Now, what I'm going to do is effectively give 2 talks. So, and if you miss both talks, because I'll be going pretty quickly, I have to acknowledge a co-worker of mine who's in the audience, Mark Raven, who is involved in both these case studies that I'll be giving you, both the forensic one and the work on acid sulfate soils that I'll be talking on in 2 talks tomorrow. So you'll be getting a 30 minutes of each, so if you miss this one, you'll certainly get a big dose of it then. What I decided to talk on to honour Malcolm is basically this word pedotechnology. And effectively, he'll probably find it pretty strange that we should have to invent such a word, and I'll explain where that word comes from in the next slide. But effectively, Malcolm, in his work in soil fertility, has communicated to farmers in a very, very easy way. He hasn't had to invent sort of pedofertility or some sort of fertility, because the fertility people communicate pretty easily to farmers. The trouble is, with podologists, we have a language of our own. And unfortunately, that language can get confused quite severely when you need to communicate with the 2 areas of work I'm going to be talking about, the one being forensic soil science, because effectively you have to communicate with jurors, policemen, detectives, so you virtually have to invent a much more simplistic language, but bear in mind that your science is pretty stable. Exactly the same way in the area of acid sulfate soils, I'll be talking about drought, a drought-induced disaster that happened in Australia over the last 4 or 5 years, in which we've had to communicate with communities and with hydrologists. So we've really had to be pretty clever in inventing a way of communicating. Now, as Larry Wilding explained in his first talk, and this is in fact based on his definition, pedology is pretty well known, and we answer questions like, what is soil like? Where does it come from? In other words, provenance. Now, the whole idea of soil science is to apply pedology to understand, predict, and solve practical problems. Now, Del Fanning has defined this as being pedotechnology and published it. And that's effectively the main emphasis of this talk. Is that pedotechnology is really applying pedology in a very practical way. And to do that, and Larry explained this very well in his talk, you need to understand the molecular or mineral level right the way through to landscape and almost at a global scale. Now, the trouble is, if you enter the field of pedotechnology, it's pretty dangerous, pretty challenging, because you are having to become involved with the justice system, which means lawyers. You also, it's a pretty dirty, dusty sort of environment. Particularly if you're working in Australia, you have to contend with things like crocodiles, the arid zone, and more importantly, this justice system. As soon as you start entering the sort of forensics area, which is the first sort of part of this talk, is you are having to interface with barristers. Only a week ago, I was cross-examined for 5.5 hours in the Supreme Court in Melbourne. It wasn't fun, but effectively, you have to explain a soil Munsell chart to the jury and X-ray diffraction to the jury. So effectively, forensics is interfacing with the legal system, whether you like it or not. Thing is, we interfacing with pathology or soil science and having to communicate that. Now, forensic soil science is not old. It is old, it's not new. In fact, the very first case was April 1856, in which Professor Ehrenberg used pathology to solve a case where some silver coins had been stolen. He just used simple soil morphology to solve it. Published in the Scientific American, 1856. Trouble is that in more recent times, the forensic laboratories, particularly in Australia and around the world, got themselves pretty tied in a knot because of the legal people, in the sense that they'd go to court and they found themselves in difficulties only using microscopy to be able to solve crimes. And then came along DNA that just took over, which meant that soil's work was totally forgotten and never used or hardly used. And it's called the sort of DNA flip side. Most of resources in forensics went to DNA, which meant that a lot of this evidence was lost. Now, there are two types of evidence. The one is the court evidence, which I'll be talking quite a bit about. The other one is intelligence, which is really counterterrorism type work. So if you do forensics work, it doesn't necessarily have to go to court. You're just supplying good soil evidence or intelligence. We established our centre in 2003, because in 2000 we solved a double murder case, which I'll talk briefly about. So what is soil forensics? Thing is, soils is a very powerful trace. Probably the most powerful when you really think about it. Now, in the area of forensic science, this guy, Edmund Locard, the famous guy who talked about this exchange principle, that if you touch anything, there'll be an exchange. Now, in doing a review, we've just written a paper in a forensic encyclopedia, and we've come up with the idea that, in fact, we believe soil is pretty close to being the most ideal form of trace evidence. And we'll explain why. There's six properties that define it as such. Soil is hardly individualistic. Larry's first talk today explained that beautifully. Diversity, architecture, the lot. It's actually very easy to characterise, much, much easier than DNA, and enlarge and, in fact, trace amounts. Soil is has a high probability of transfer and retention. The analogy, mud sticks. Soil sticks, I can tell you. We've just completed our 89th investigation, and soil occurs in clothing, when you start looking at it, in shoes, you name it. It can be quickly collected, separated, and concentrated. It's almost invisible. That's the beauty of soils. The baddies, the crooks think that soils, for example, lipstick you can see, or blood you can see, and you can remove it. Soils are very difficult to remove, and they're not aware of it. And of course, they're computer databases, they're not good, but at least they are there. Now, the basic principles that are used in soil forensics is to compare or not compare. The trouble is, we use the degree of probability. And in a theoretical sense, no two soils are exactly the same. You saw from Larry's first talk today that even clay thin particles can be different to what the matrix looks like. So in a theoretical sense, two soils are never alike, even two samples if you separate them in a lump. In an absolute sense, you can never really say they come from the same place. But we know from that first Ehrenberg example, 1856, and many, many more since then, that we can, in fact, assign a low, a moderate, or a high degree of probability that a sample was or was not derived from a given place. So what Mark Raven and I have done within our centre is we've developed And we developed this earlier on in, as part of our cases that went to court situations. We've now developed a guide or a broad guideline that goes with our cases that actually explains these broad guidelines that we use in forensic soil science. And this is an ongoing development in which we're refining it. And we are thankful to the courts for helping refine it for us. So effectively, the guidelines outline, first of all, how soils are collected and how they're sampled. And of course, you have to understand what a question soil is, a control soil, an alibi soil. I won't be going into that in this talk. I'll only be dealing with the soil characterisation and evaluation, because that links more to do with the sort of stuff Malcolm's interested in. And of course, unfortunately, you have to understand this expert witness part of it, which is very important. Now, what we've done, and this is the petrotechnology technology part of it, is we've actually divided, in terms of our guide, and this is mainly for the jury, mainly for the barristers, to explain to them that what we do is we have different stages of evaluation of the soil samples when they come in. So at stage one, we just do what a pedologist normally does, describe a soil in terms of initial characterisation using a Munsell and so on. Now we use that for screening and sample selection. We then go to phase two, in which we do semi-detailed characterisation, and 9 times out of 10 we would sieve it. And I'll explain that why in a couple of the case studies that I'll give you. And there we would always use X-ray diffraction. Fortunately in CSIRO we're blessed with good gadgets and with fantastic technical support in Mark Raven, who is a world expert in terms of X-ray soil diffraction work. And for me to go to court, or for him to go to court, X-ray diffraction, I have to say, is the definitive. Stage three is really doing much, much more detailed characterization, micro work, micro diffraction, electron microscopy, and so on. Quite often, we might not get to stage three. Stage four is putting the whole thing together. And that's what pedologists do, is put things together and actually develop almost a sort of conceptual model. And this simplifies it really. This is the systematic approach. Stage one, whole soil. Stage two, we normally sieve it. Stage three, much more detailed work if we do mineral fractionation or microdiffraction. Stage three is putting it together by, in some cases, even classifying soils. And those are just all the details, type of stuff we use. I'm not going to go through each and every one of them. Want more information, come to tomorrow's talk. Stage one, effectively, is basically what a pedologist does. Use a Munsell colour, texture, and so on. And by way of how we do this, I'm only going to go through this very quickly. This is a double murder case. It's one of the first ones we did, in which a double murder was committed. A shovel was found in the boot of a car. No DNA could be got from the blood on this shovel, so they had to use soil information. As part of stage one, the first thing we did was describe the soil on the shovel, the architecture, if you like. And in this case, it was a 7.5 by R8 over 4, large angular quartz particles in white fragments, the pH and so on. And it gave us a pretty good idea of what that looked like, that the soil on the shovel. To explain why we sieve a soil, this is another case we did. I can't remember when, but it would have been, maybe our 30th case. But effectively, this was a hit and run case in which these Nike shoes, we love Nike shoes because these things really absorb soil. And when the baddie was running through a stream in Adelaide, he picked up some of the soil. But of course, when he took off and they only found him about 5 hours later, only the very fine fragments stayed on the shoe, as you can see there. The coarse fragments, when he went through, obviously fell off. When we went back to the crime scene, or the site where the police saw him run away, we could collect that soil, and of course, the obvious thing to do as a pedologist, sieve the two, make a comparison, and then Mark Raven would run an X-ray diffraction pattern, and as you can see, the less than 50 micron fractions are virtually identical. The guy was convicted, still sitting in jail. Getting back to the double murder case, here's the deflection patterns on the shovel, the front and the back of the shovel, and you can see pretty similar mineralogy, quartz, kaolinite, mica and talc. Of course, stage three involves much more micro-diffraction work. This is Mark actually taking some soil from a shoe that's got a very tiny bit on, and he could cut it and actually put it in the diffractometer and get some sort of pattern. Or we might even do more micro work. In this case, this is a synchrotron to do even more detailed type work. Here's a situation of a stage four in which we actually were given a shovel. We were told, where does this all come from in Australia? This is a counter-terrorism case. And we could then, based on this information, interrogate our database or knowledge of soils and narrow it down. In this instance, it was some sort of podzol. And in that way, we could then, from the police evidence, develop, if you like, a sort of soil regolith model based on that soil from the shovel. But we wouldn't use soil taxonomy or some fancy classification system because you're communicating with detectives and police that want to, in fact, use this information to find out where a certain something was buried in an area. So we developed just a simple pedotechnology type thing, a sort of a yellow-brown soil, yellow soil, but back we're actually using soil taxonomy and our Australian soil classification to find out where this occurs. And from this little model, the detectives or the police could actually know where to look for a certain object. Now, getting back to the double murder case, we, in terms of using maps, we had some information. We could actually go to a quarry where we had some information that, in fact, the person might well have been in this vicinity, and based on our soil maps and geological maps, this is where it likely might have happened. Visited the site, I collected samples from the quarry, Mark ran the diffraction patterns, and here they are here. And we got quartz, kaolinite, mica and talc. And then we then made a comparison because the colours were almost identical. Mark re-ran the X-ray patterns, and you can see from the black and the blacks from the quarry, the red is from the shovel, and when you put the two over each other, they're almost virtually identical. And from this particular sample, we were within 9 metres of locating this particular site where the two bodies were buried. Now, based on this information, we've, up to this point in time, just done our 87th case or inquiry, and we would have saved courts millions of dollars, no court hearings. It certainly helps, and I guess I think it's a nice feeling, we're saving the world. But effectively, we've done 3 cases in which we did a quotation to do the work. The detectives told the baddies that we were just going to analyse their soils, and they gave in and agreed to collaborate and admit guilt. So just having a forensic centre was quite good. Now, I'm going to switch because this is the second part of the talk in which we've actually applied pedotechnology to an environmental setting. And in this instance, we're actually talking more about acid sulphate soils, because effectively what has happened in this situation is that Australia had their most severe drought in living memory, and all the streams and rivers in many places were starting to dry up, particularly the wetlands and some of the big lakes. And you can see from this here that this is what the river looks like when it's full of water. When it starts draining out, the fish are dying, and not only that, but you've actually got wetlands that are dried completely. And in fact, what we found was in these environments, acid sulfate soils had actually formed that had never been there before. And I'm just going to take a couple of case studies here, mainly from the Lower Lakes area, which I'll show you where that occurs now, and show you how these mechanistic and models can be used to predict and assist in the kind of information that can be used for rehabilitation and to identify the severity of the problem. Now, the places I'm talking about, this is Australia. This is what is called the Murray-Darling Basin, and I'm going to talk about the Lower Lakes, which are down here, and this is South Australia here, this is where I live. But effectively, this area down here are very shallow lakes, averaging about 2 to 3 metres in depth. And effectively what happened was that over many years, these lakes were actually made to be full. They put locks in, weirs in, you name it, and made sure that they were always full of fresh water. Now, I have to give you a little brief lecture on what is an acid sulfate soil. But effectively, an acid sulfate soil are soils that contain pyrite. And when these pyritic sediments, or soils that have been protected or kept in an anaerobic condition underwater, when they oxidize, when the pyrite oxidizes, and you heard Nick give a bit of a talk about this earlier, this pyrite can oxidize, combine with water, and form sulfuric acid. This produces a lot of acidity. Of course, it can produce salt efflorescences and produce minerals that can store acidity. These are some of these examples. These are these little mineral indicators. And we give Mark Rove and I are giving a talk on a mineral called sidronatrite tomorrow. And you can see these salt efflorescences are pretty important as indicators. We use acid-base accounting. And I have to tell my American colleagues that we've come up with a new definition of sulfidic material. And so we now have a thing called hypersulfidic material that basically defines these in a bit more detail. Now, in terms of the PETA technology concept, instead of using soil taxonomy and the Australian system, we've developed a very simple thing like organic soils, clay soils, and a thing called sulfuric soils. In other words, a soil that has sulfuric acid in it, we just call it a sulfuric soil. And these soils are important because they can contaminate environments, they form very quickly when they're exposed, and as I explained earlier, these soils are actually formed originally because they were made to be full of water. They weren't wetting and drying like that had happened for thousands of years. And pyrite accumulated in very large amounts in these lower lakes and in the Murray system. So when this drought hit, these soils or these subaqueous soils or sediments were exposed for the first time in like 80 to 100 years and acidified. And this is just showing this drought that devastated these areas over the last 5 years. And this is to give you some idea of what this looks like pictorially. This is what it looked like when we sampled in 2007, went back in November 2008. In 2009, that whole area, that exact same area, was exposed with pHs ranging in the area of 0.5 to 3.5, with all these salt efflorescences exposed with pretty toxic salts, epsomite, gypsum, thinodite, alunogen, pretty bad stuff in these acid areas. We could use the simple PETA technology type terminology to describe the processes historically and in cross-section exactly what's actually happening. And what would happen when these areas are reflooded? So these acid soils that have been acid for about a year, when they were reflooded by wetting, actually the waters themselves had pHs of as low as 3.3 and 4 in some of the areas. Here's examples of showing these flooded areas that are pretty acid. We could form models, as I've just explained, showing how these things change. We could then translate that into maps to show exactly what had happened, and we could predict these areas that would become acid based on the bathymetry, and something like 20,000 hectares of sulfuric material formed around these lakes. That information was used to construct wet areas, to pump water into these areas to prevent these areas from oxidizing further. That information is used to develop areas that should be revegetated, and they could fly in lime areas that were actually acid. Just to conclude, PETA technology can predict environmental impacts, as I've just shown. It can solve forensic cases. Bit of a nice little cartoon there. PETA technology is important to be able to use to communicate to, for example, jurors, and must be put into a less petacentric sort of way. And I acknowledge Malcolm for all these dangerous things he's put me through over the years. This is me here, in case that's him there. 1971, almost 40 years ago. So Malcolm, I can blame you for all these horrible things you've got me into. Thank you very much, and I acknowledge all my colleagues.